Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Konser, and today I'll be taking you back to December of 2011, when I was joined in the studio by animator and comics artist Vera Brosgel, who had just published the graphic novel Anya's Ghost. Vera has published many books in the years since, and her work has won the Harvey and Eisner Awards, as well as the Caldecott Honor. She'll be bringing her new book, Plain Jane and the Mermaid, to the Portland Book Festival on November 2nd. And now, Vera Brosgel, recorded on December 5th, 2011.
We've got a guest in the studio today who is a creator of both comics and animation. She's also a story artist on the upcoming film from Laika, Paranorman. Welcome to Words and Pictures, Vera Brosgel.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So the book that you've just published, you're an author of a graphic novel, sort of a gothic graphic novel, called Anya's Ghost. And right here on the cover, Neil Gaiman gives it a nice blurb.
Yes, that was very nice of him.
And this is, like I said, it's kind of a gothic graphic novel in the best sense. There's a ghost, but well before the ghost makes its appearance, the main character is already kind of haunted.
Yeah, I suppose so. If you call self-loathing being haunted, I guess she's haunted by her past of another country and having an accent and an embarrassing family and things like that. Yeah.
Her name is Anya, and you came up with a great Slavic last name,
God,
which I'm not sure I can even pronounce.
It's Borzakovskaya, and that took a while because I had to, I was Googling basically for an authentic Russian name because they're harder to think of than you'd think. And I think that's actually the name of an Olympic wrestler. That sounded pretty good, so I borrowed that.
And Anya is having a little trouble fitting in sort of a bourgeois New England public school environment. Mm-hmm. And in the great old tradition of such authors as Nathaniel Hawthorne and Washington Irving, she disturbs an old resting place.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know why they wouldn't have closed that well up. It's not really that that far off the trail. But she falls down a big abandoned pit, and at the bottom of it, there's the skeleton of the last person who fell down. And she doesn't get terribly beat up. She just hurts her wrist a little bit. But the last person that fell down obviously died, and they're still haunting their skeleton. And it's the ghost of a 16-year-old girl named Emily, about the same age as Anya.
With plaintive dialogue, she talks about how she was hurt in the wrong way and couldn't cry out and died of thirst down there.
Yeah, I don't think she had a pleasant end, which might have contributed to her mental state.
And in the grand tradition of ghost stories, there's always something that the ghosts are clinging to. And once Anya picks up her little finger bone, that's it. That's the start of something very interesting and revealing and transforming.
Yeah, I figure Anya's such a jerk at the beginning. There's no way she'd help the ghost out on her own, so she winds up dragging it along without her knowledge. And the bone was a nice, small way to do that.
And I wonder if animation has something to do with the timing that you have in the book, because the suspense comes out of the story in these slow reveals. There's these twists and turns, and it just seems like it's going into this nice direction of maybe things are going to resolve really well. And I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler, but but things actually turn pretty disturbing.
Well, I don't think anyone would read it if it was just the straightforward, solving a murder and being friends with everybody and getting the guy and everything kind of story. So obviously something horrible is going to happen to somebody. Yeah, I don't know. That's what keeps me interested.
And it also reminds me of a short animated piece that you directed called Snowbow.
Directed? Oh, dear. cobbled together on a deadline at college, yes.
This is something I think people can find online if they go to YouTube, and it's Snow, S-N-O-W-B-O.
Yeah, there's also a little link to it on my website. It's under like the animation section. If you go to the gallery part, it's not too hard to find. VeraBee.com, V-E-R-A-B-E-E.com.
And in Snowbow, it starts out and it's almost like one of those nice Peanuts holiday specials. You know, it's very happy colors and fun winter day activities. And again, things take some twists and turns. Do you ever sort of delight in terrorizing your own characters like some a harsh deity kind of?
Well, I never actually realized the parallel between Anya's Ghost and Snowbow until just this second. guess I'm into children being friends with dead things. Should probably knock that off. Yeah, I mean, totally. It's fun to play God and put your characters through the ringer. That's sort of what makes it interesting to write.
Well, you know, I wonder, did you grow up with a lot of folk tales from Russia?
There's a lot of torture and corpses everywhere.
Well, there are these great stories of corpses and vampires in Russia. And of course, Baba Yaga goes bad.
I'm very scared of Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga is considered very real by some folks in the Slavic traditions.
If anybody doesn't know what that is, it's an old lady who lives in a house with chicken legs and rides around in a mortar and pestle. Mike Mignola is very fond of her as well.
Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy.
Yeah, she hangs out with Hellboy from time to time.
And there's a rather nicer version of Baba Yaga that's in the book Hereville. We've had Barry Deutsch on the show, and you've heard some comparisons between your book and Hereville. Scary books with a lot of suspense and creepiness that are being well received by teenagers and young adults.
Yeah, I think kids love that stuff. I've never heard anybody being too scared by my book, and the same with Coraline. Everybody was worried that, like, oh, kids are gonna find it too scary, these kids are losing their eyes. Spoiler. I know, it's fine. Like, children don't like being talked down to. And I didn't write my book for a young adult audience or a child audience at all. I just wrote it for myself.
And actually, it seems to work best, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I'm sure Barry did the same thing. Like, all you have to do is just be careful to take out anything too objectionable. And you can sell it as a young adult book and a children's book. And it's kind of like a trick.
And I was reading a little biographical essay you did for the Wall Street Journal not too long ago, reading about your arrival as a five-year-old from Russia with your brother, with your mom, and all of the interesting things you went through as a young child. I see a lot of parallels. It seems like you really mined your own material for Anya's Ghost.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wanted to do something that was honest, and I think it's much easier to write things that have happened to you, but I need some kind of filter for it to make it interesting for me to draw. And I also, like, everything's automatically a little bit more fun if there's some sort of paranormal element to it. So yeah, it's just basically my own life altered and disguised and cobbled together with things that happen to other people. I mean, some of the characters are real people, some of them aren't. I'm not really that much like Anya in the sense that I was a much better student than her, and I never smoked, and I was just a really good kid. But I had the same feelings, and I think everybody has those same feelings. Like, that part's totally universal, and I think that's what people wind up relating to.
So you had a Russian accent at the age of five, and you were trying desperately to drop it.
Well, I don't know if I was consciously trying to drop it, but I got put in ESL, and I got rid of it fast enough, and as I, like, became older and a little bit more conscious of what gets you bullied, I was so relieved that I didn't have that accent anymore, because the Dima character in that book is based on a real kid.
Yes, Dima is another Russian that the character of Anya refers to as Fobby, which means fresh off the boat.
Yeah, he hadn't had as much time to disguise himself as an American person. When I was in second grade, there was a kid pretty much just like that who looked like that, and he didn't have a good time. And I sort of watched him, and I guess I should have, if I were a more mature person at the age of 9, I would have stood up for him or something, but I just wanted to distance myself as much as possible, and I did.
And what's interesting is you ended up doing quite a bit of globetrotting when you were young. You spent a couple of years in England.
Mm-hmm. And so then I had an American accent to deal with.
What part of England were you in?
My mom got a job in London, so we moved there when I was 12, I guess, yeah. It was weird, because they loved me in England, because I sounded like all the TV shows, so I'd get asked about Friends and stuff all the time, like if America was more ahead on the show Friends or whatever, and I would be asked to repeat things and say things, and I was sort of a novelty for a while, and after a while it wore off, and I was just like a regular loser again.
So from England you came back to New York, and things were kind of different after that in your high school days.
Yeah, there were a lot of Russians around all of a sudden, because I went to high school in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, which has a big immigrant population. I had Russian friends, I had Chinese friends, I had Italian friends, didn't really have any like plain old regular New England American friends anymore. And nobody was uncomfortable with their heritage that I could see. Like, it was fine. You went to the special Russian grocery store and he spoke Russian on the street, and it just wasn't anything to be embarrassed about, because everyone had sort of like this little comfortable mini Russia that they lived in. And yeah, it was kind of a shift for me around then. I think it sort of planted the seed for for sort of starting to pay a little more attention to my culture and maybe not repressing it as much.
I guess you and your family were in the first wave of religious refugees when Perestroika came in, when the Soviet Union started to kind of open up in the late 80s.
Yeah, we got in for being fake Jewish. It was great.
Really?
Yeah, there were all these Jewish organizations. Well, my dad was Jewish, but he converted like shortly before we immigrated. And we were helped by these Jewish aid organizations to get into the country. And he told them, you know, I'm not actually Jewish anymore. But they said, it's fine, just don't tell anybody.
Because oh, wow.
we were still, you know, political refugees. My mom couldn't get work because of her religion and politics and stuff like that.
Orthodox?
Yeah, my mom was Orthodox.
Okay.
So, yeah, we got into the country. And as a kid, I didn't really understand. Like, I didn't notice that it was weird that we only went to Hanukkah parties and all of our friends were Jewish. And I loved it. I loved the Hanukkah parties. I miss them.
You mentioned that there's so many autobiographical elements in Anya's Ghost that people want to know more about the mom and the little brother and
you don't really though.
And the best friend who's also the frenemy.
Mm-hmm. Siobhan.
Yeah, it seems like Anya's best or maybe only friend is there's this terrible sadistic rivalry going on.
She's not the warmest person. I think probably a lot of my personality as a younger person is in that character. I wasn't maybe very sensitive to other people. Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't a particularly sweet person, I guess. But, you know, that's the best she can do. You know, that's why she's unhappy with her life. She doesn't have an awesome best friend.
Well, you seem so innocent now, which is why when I read Anya's Ghost or look at Snowbo, I was just a little chilled, like, ooh, who is this person who's so cruel, who's just turning this lovely little folky scenario into something so desolate?
I've had a hard life, I guess.
You went back to Russia a few years ago, and what was that like for you?
Yeah, it had been, I think, 11 years since I'd been there, and surprise, surprise, it's pretty different, not under communism. There's a lot more stuff. I remember there not being any stuff. I remember some of the stores would just have empty shelves and my mom would have to wait in the stupid bread lines and everything. And you go back and there's just luxury everywhere. Everybody's got a fancy car, promiscuously parked, and fancy clothes.
Well, everybody that you see.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a huge disparity between the wealthy and the poor, but there's so many people with new money and they're definitely flashing it. And it seems like people in the middle are living more comfortably than they were. I mean, I think if we were still there, we'd definitely be better off than we were when we left. We were living in, you know, one room, a shared apartment, government style, all that stuff. And now my mom owns that whole apartment. So
she owns an apartment in
Moscow, yeah.
In Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what was it like to go back to Russia with your religious refugee mom?
It was great. She'd been back a bunch of times because she, you know, visits her friends and her mother, who was alive at the time, was there, and we sort of took care of her a little bit. It was really good because my Russian is not, it's fluent, but it's not, I'm not confident enough to get by. I have the Russian skills of a 5-year-old, so I can ask where my mommy is. That I can't, like, order dinner or anything. So it was helpful to have a grown-up to lead me around. And also she knew the city way better than I did, of course. So we went to art galleries and just walked all over it. Tretyakov Art Gallery, I think, is the best one I've ever been to in my entire life. And I would love to go back just for that gallery. I think I went there twice.
Right. You're a big fan of Russian art. Did that sort of develop late?
Yeah.
Did you just discover it kind of later in life?
Yeah, totally. I am now, but before I just sort of... I didn't really care. I didn't want to know anything about it. Anything my mom thought was cool, I didn't want to have anything to do with, which I think is fairly normal teen behavior. But yeah, there's some good stuff. Ilya Repin is definitely my favorite. I think he is kind of like a late 1800s guy, but he did a lot of portraits and stuff. But he was just amazing at expression, just getting a lot of emotion just into the eyes, and they look really wet, and it's definitely worth Googling.
One of the sad things to me, you know, that happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Eastern Bloc was that there's so much less funding for animation in Eastern Europe and Russia. And so many animators that I love were doing amazing stuff in the 70s and 80s, you know, out of Prague and Zagreb and Moscow. And the funding isn't, it has to be a little bit more commercial now than it was back then.
Well, I think there was a lot more funding, but I'm sure they were, you know, censored quite a bit in what they could do. That's what I grew up watching, a lot of Yuri Norstein films and stuff. Like, a lot of them are way more artistic than would fly on television in the States. But I watched Tale of Tales, and I had no idea what was going on, but I knew I liked it. And I'm still watching it now, and I still like it. I think there's still a lot of animation coming out of Russia. I don't know how to get access to it, really. Some of it's on YouTube, and every once in a while I'll find a cool short or something. But I think Yuri Norstein's still working. He was here, I think, a couple years ago. I really wanted to go. I couldn't make it because of work.
I'm SW Conser, and you're listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, featuring animator and comics artist Vera Brosgol, who had just published the graphic novel Anya's Ghost. Vera will be appearing at the Portland Book Festival on November 2nd, alongside Carla Arenas Valenti and moderator Brina Bard. They'll be in the Judy Cinema at 3 p.m., talking about new takes on folk tales and fairy tales and young girls who rescue themselves.
Well, we're talking about timing. We're talking about the timing of the story in Anya's Ghost, how scenes would play themselves out. But also what I've noticed in here is that there are pages and pages of the story unfolding without dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that animators are really amazing at. As I think it was Chuck Jones said, you can turn the sound off and still understand the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I like drawing a lot better than writing, so I sort of prefer to write through drawing, if that makes sense. Like I wrote the book as thumbnails rather than as a script, because if I did a script, it would probably be like 20 pages of actual talking. But I think it's much more entertaining to try to show what's going on. I don't know if that's unique to animation, but I think, yeah, I guess maybe it is, because animators do probably way more drawing than a lot of other professions, and sort of the most comfortable way to communicate for those kinds of people.
And that's, you know, it looks so simple. I look in Anya's Ghost, and it looks so simple how the story is told, mostly through pictures, but that's deceptive. I mean, it's not simple. It's not easy to make a wordless story.
No. Thank you. I'm glad you like it. I tried to plan it all out from beginning to end. I guess that's the reason that it works. I did this trick that I learned from my friend Jen Wang, where you write your plot points out on post-it notes and you put those up on the wall, and then you can look at them and you can just kind of see the entire story. Instead of drawing from beginning to end and hoping it works out, you just get a really macro perspective on it. And like, I noticed an entire post-it note that was completely pointless, so I took it off the wall, and the story was much better after that. And the only problem with that is the glue on those things isn't the best, so sometimes I'd come home and the whole thing would be on the floor.
Oh, no.
But they have a software now called, it's a program called Scrivener, and it's like a digital version of the same thing. And I've been trying that out. Ah. Yeah, that's part of it. It's like a cork board kind of thing.
Well, another thing that's really important is getting the expressions exactly right. And in your case, you do very simple line-based expressions in Anya's Ghost and in your animation as well. Scott McCloud, who's written about comics, understanding comics, says the fewer lines you have, the less detail you have, the more that the reader can relate to your mm-hmm. characters. And also, I think it's another trait of animators yeah. that they learn to whittle down until there's just very little there.
Yeah, it's called line mileage, I think. That's what I remembered from school. You want to minimize your line mileage. Because when you're animating, you're drawing the same thing hundreds of times. So if you add a belt to your character, you're going to be drawing that belt a lot more than you want to. So you need to really think, do I need this belt? And usually you don't.
So you actually started doing webcomics when you were 16. You did a comic called Return to Sender.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for quite a while, didn't it? You had some fans.
Yeah, I had a few fans. I think I did it for about a year or two. I think I got a couple hundred pages done. And then I went to college and found something better to do with my time, I guess.
How did that come about? How did Return to Sender come about?
All my friends were doing webcomics. I was talking online with Dylan McConis and Erica Moen and Jen Wang, and they all had like long-form webcomics. I think Erica didn't. She used to doing short stories. But yeah, it just seemed like fun. Just put up a page every week and, you know, talk to your fans and talk to your friends, and it's just a good motivator to crank out some work. And I was taking a year off after high school before I started college, because I finished high school a little younger than I think I would have liked.
Me too. I was 16.
Yeah, I was 16 too. You don't want to leave home when you're 16. It's a little too soon. So yeah, I just pretty much did nothing for a year except for draw comics. And it was fun, but I didn't plan it out the way that I did this book. I didn't really have as tight of a outline to go off of. So I made sort of a plot, not necessarily a mistake, but I did something I didn't like. And there was no way to go back and fix it, really, because it was all on the internet already and everybody had read it. And that kind of contributed to me sort of shoving it under the rug and moving on to concentrate on college. And I would get so many sad emails, and I still get the occasional one, but I think everybody realizes at this point, like, how many years has it been? I'm not going to do that math.
That's the wonder and the horror of the internet, though, is the wonder of it is you get all these fans out there. The horror of it is there's so many people following you that they've all got an opinion, mm-hmm. or they notice when you need to backtrack and you can't do that.
Yeah. And they're owed more free comics.
It's like people just have nothing to do better mm-hmm. than to make stupid critiques of stuff that actual creative people are doing.
Yeah, never read comments on anything. It's never worth it. That's why I'm too scared to read Goodreads. It's nothing but internet comments.
Yeah, so I don't know if this was just happenstance, if it was just luck on your part, or if this was intentional, that you ended up here in Oregon at Leica Animation Studios working on two creepy ghost stories that are being done in stop motion animation. And the first one was Coraline, which mm-hmm. has been out for a couple of years now. And the new one is Paranorman.
Yep.
Chris Butler, who was the head of story for Coraline, is directing this one. And Paranorman seems to have a few things in common with Anya and Anya's ghost.
Yeah, it was, I actually wrote Anya's ghost during Coraline. And there were discussions during Paranorman where story suggestions would come up that were kind of a little too similar to what I was doing, particularly with the end of the book. And I would have to pipe up and be like, please, for personal reasons, can we not do that? And they were very, very cool about it, and that stuff got kind of ignored. But yeah, I think I just got super, super lucky that the first two movies were so like perfectly in line with my taste, I guess. Like, most people don't get to do that. Most people have to work on whatever's around. But yeah, it was like super good timing that Henry Selick saw my film and they liked it and it fit in with what they wanted, and they didn't care that I didn't have any experience, and they flew me out here and let me learn on the job, and it was perfect. I love my job. It's the most ideal situation.
And your job is storyboards.
Storyboarding, which is a lot like comics, actually. Drawing things in little boxes.
Okay, so what you do at Leica, the storyboarding for these feature films, this helps actually winnow out some of the ideas that aren't going to work, some of the transitions that aren't going to work, the timing and movements that aren't going to work, because the boards are these little panels that get put together with the sound, and in the rough state, they become what's called an animatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little different in feature film versus television, where for television it's going to be animated in another country usually. So the boards have to be a much more locked down template of the final product. Like, all the characters have to be on model, the background has to be right, there's got to be little arrows and explaining notes all over everything. And with feature boards, it's much more kind of loose. You know, you're still refining the script, things are just being tested out to see if it works. A lot of the time you're writing your own dialogue, not a lot of the time, occasionally. That's always fun. But it's much more an exploratory process rather than like a strict layout.
Oh, and it's all done in-house.
Yeah.
You also have an ability to influence the final film itself, mm-hmm. because if you're going off-model a little bit, so to speak, if you're altering the character to show something psychological or mm-hmm. or some intent or what they're going to do, that actually might influence the way that the animators do things in the final film.
Yeah. It can go both ways, too. Sometimes I have a friend at work named Julian, and he does hilarious drawings, like awesome googly-eyed giant mouth cartoon drawings, but the puppets can't necessarily do that. I think that's more a problem with stop motion than with CG or something. You're a bit more limited with what the puppet can actually do. So a lot of the time the animator would love to do exactly what he drew, but it's just not actually possible.
Now, for our listeners who haven't seen Coraline, explain a little bit about what stop motion animation is. A lot of people call it puppet animation, mm-hmm. and one version or another goes back all the way to Willis O'Brien and King Kong. Ray Harryhausen is mm-hmm. a name a lot of people recognize, who did Jason and the Argonauts, Voyage of Sinbad.
Yeah. My boyfriend's obsessed with Harryhausen. It's basically a doll that has a metal skeleton inside of it that allows it to be moved, and it can hold a position. So you you take a shot of each separate position. So it's like the separate frames of drawn animation, except you have to move the puppet to get from one frame to the other. And the problem with that is it can only be straight ahead. If you screw up, you can't, you know, go back a few pages and redo it.
Yeah, it seems like there's something about just being in a room full of creative people mm-hmm. that just ups your game.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I love having a studio job and not just doing comics full time. I think if I were trapped in my little office-y room 24/7, it would be horrible. It's nice to come in and talk to people who aren't necessarily doing the exact same thing you're doing. The story area is the most unapproachable area in the building, probably. It's really, really quiet and dark, and we all have headphones on. They never, ever bring anyone cool up on tours.
So when celebrity guests are led through the Leica studios, they like to look at these great sets, these amazing rigged backgrounds and characters all over them, and ooh and ah over that sort of thing.
And the puppet shop. They love the puppet shop. That's always like the first place they go. My boyfriend works in the puppet shop. He makes armatures. So every single celebrity he'll have an awesome story about, and I'll just be sulking upstairs. Sometimes I'll, like, if it's really important, I'll make an excuse to come downstairs and loiter in the puppet area looking like I'm doing something. But usually I don't even know that somebody famous has come through.
And what's coming up? Do you have anything else in the pipeline, or do you have any dream projects that you're looking forward to doing?
I have another story idea that I need to finish my proposal for. My agent's sort of been hounding me to get it over to her. I know what I want to do next, basically. It's just a matter of settling down and starting, because I remember exactly how much work that was and how long it took, and it's pretty tough. About three years.
Anya's Ghost is over 200 pages, so that's pretty amazing.
And everybody says it's such a fast read. You can get through it in like 20 minutes to half an hour.
But only if you don't linger over the art.
Well, it's not a dense book either. Like, I like looking at those sometimes where you can just sort of spend forever digging through a page, like a Chris Ware comic or something. But I think maybe that's an animation thing. You just want to keep it moving, move it along, get where you're supposed to go.
Especially when it's a scary or suspenseful story. You don't want people to linger. People just want to go straight through and then get to the meat of it.
Yeah. Also, there's only so much background detail I'm willing to draw.
Well, Vera Broskal, it's been a pleasure to have you today on Words and Pictures to talk about your animation and your new graphic novel from First Second Books, Anya's Ghost. Thank you so much for coming in, and where can people see more of your work and find out more about Anya's Ghost?
Verabee.com, V-E-R-A-B-E-E.com. Thanks for having me. I had a great time.
Thank you, and thanks to our listeners. We're going to go out with a little bit of banjo playing from Snowbow. And who's the musician on this?
It was a fine young man named Sam Allison.
Sam Allison. Thanks, and stay tuned for an afternoon of music.
Well, you've been listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in December of 2011, and featuring animator and comics artist Vera Broskal, who had just published the graphic novel Anya's Ghost. Vera will be appearing at the Portland Book Festival on November 2nd, alongside Carla Arenas Valenti and moderator Brina Bard. They'll be in the Judy Cinema at 3 p.m., talking about new takes on folktales and fairy tales and young girls who rescue themselves. I'm S.W. Conser. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.